there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Dan Van Voris. We are doing episode 3 of Christianity in America today. Dan has provided us with a pretty comprehensive outline here. We're going to get through this in about 6 episodes total, so we're at the end of today, we'll be at the halfway mark, and we're just jumping into different periods of American history, which is fun, and we've also had just so many listeners sort of ask, hey, why don't Lutherans have a lot of influence in American Christianity? And I think partially this show will, you know, unfold that answer.
I'd be very happy to answer that at some point. There's a number of reasons why Lutherans don't have much of a story. Not to say they don't, but one of the reasons is the fascination in American history with the Northeast. Mm. And so much of American history is told as sort of Northeastern history. And that bothers people to no end in the South. Mm-hmm. And it should bother people in the Midwest, except they're too, you know, polite to say anything. But it's the same, that idea that we just tend to not tell the stories. But when you look at the history of Lutheranism, you know, from the Muhlenbergs, who were very active in the American Revolution. I mean, there are a number of stories, but I think a secondary sort of line to that is also just the nature of Lutheranism and two kingdoms. And I think there's a reason why we look so quiet. And I think that's somewhat by design.
Mark Knoll took that on one time in an article, I think, at First Things.
Called Unremarkably Lutheran, yeah, I believe was the name of that. Yeah, it was some article that was written by that. That it's by design that we're not super involved. But of course, as Americans, this story, even if it's not Lutheran, is still our story because it's affected all of us, and mm-hmm. it's affected our parishes and everyone we know who goes to church.
So the main topic for today is the Great Awakening. But before we dive right in, I just wanted to promote some of the other things going on at 1517 right now. Generally, across the podcast network, we have new-ish things now, but Christian History Almanac, which Dan is the voice behind and the writer behind that show, is pretty much blowing up for us. It's a really great podcasting success.
Yeah, great.
And if you haven't checked it out yet, I really encourage you to go to the 1517 website and go subscribe. You can subscribe on iTunes or any of your favorite podcasting apps. And Dan had a pretty good idea. And one of these days, on the end of a shorter Thinking Fellows episode, I'm going to put an episode of that on there. It's only 5 minutes long, so it won't really disrupt things. So if you haven't listened to it yet, you'll get an opportunity in the near future to do so. Also, we have some tickets remaining for Here We Still Stand. I think on the last two episodes, I said under 100. I think it's now under 70 tickets left.
I heard
left.
35 the other day.
Oh, okay. So it's really...
That was a few days ago.
This keeps up.
Basically,
faster,
if you haven't downloaded this as soon as it dropped...
Yeah. Yes. So you
but still check.
This is probably your last opportunity to buy a ticket for Here We Still Stand. If you've been thinking about it, if you haven't been thinking about it, you should consider it. Follow the link in the show notes. It'll take you to the Here We Still Stand website where you can register for, I think it's 20% off, or it's $25 off, whatever that equals now. So that's $199 registration currently, minus 25. You get the picture. It's about $175 to register. So, yeah, please check that out. And there will be a code in the show notes, PNET19, for your discount. All right, guys. I think that pretty much covers the introduction matter. And now we can jump into the Great Awakening. The first question on my mind, Dan, and you can go wherever you want, but is what the heck is an awakening?
What is an awakening? It's a term that was given by the people themselves. And it has to do with what they would say is an awakening of the spirit. Moving at a particular time in a particular place. And so the Great Awakening, although there are two, and we want to distinguish between the two of them, the Great Awakening is an awakening of a spirituality in American Christianity, colonial and then American. And when I say that, it sounds maybe broad and ill-defined, and that's kind of what the awakening was. When we say spiritual, it's okay because that's all the gushiness that comes with that fits the awakening. And so it's a phrase that works. You know, I think it's the beginning of a distinctly American version of Christianity. You know, when we talked the past couple weeks, we've talked about the colonials coming over, and that's so Puritan, that's English, that's Scottish. When we talk about the founding generation, that's Enlightenment ideas and Scottish common sense ideas and really harkening back to the old world. By the time we get around to the Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening, just to put a date on it, mm-hmm. let's go 1730s to 1790s. So it's straddling that revolutionary age. That's the first Great Awakening. You know, it's really the beginning of an American religion. And so it has, you know, it's heavily influenced by Protestantism. It's influenced by Lutheranism, as we saw with James Madison last time, that some of the very basic ideas of the Reformation come in. But it also has some of those peculiarities that we have in American religion.
Is Edwards the chief figure?
Edwards is, yeah. Yeah, Jonathan Edwards, who is a philosopher and a philosopher in the academic world, and then a preacher, and uh-huh. most famous for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the prototypical first Great Awakening text. You know, okay. is all, it's, I mean, and I don't know if you guys read that sermon before, but it's while it's dramatic, you know, R.C. Sproul could have given it. You know, it's not that radical in terms of its theology from a Reformed perspective, but it certainly struck a chord with those American people. And
well, it's got a catchy title.
Yeah, it does. And sometimes we know that's all it needs, right?
It's Caleb, the eighth issue of Christian History is devoted to this subject.
Okay, yeah.
I think those copies can still be gotten.
I believe they have a digital archive.
Back in 85. Issue 8, Jonathan Edwards and the Great Awakening.
Great. I'll add it to the show notes.
Yeah, Edwards is the main character. Some others, you know, Edwards, this whole sort of community of religious figures in the 18th century. And you've got the Wesleys and Whitfield, who are coming over from England. And Edwards, who, you know, as we already mentioned, is kind of the really significant figure. This is the end of the Mather dynasty, M-A-T-H-E-R, Cotton and Increase and Samuel. These were kind of the colonial families. Now that influence is ending, and we're seeing the new figures either really being celebrities. You know, George Whitefield was a celebrity. Jonathan Edwards, when 5,000 people come out to hear you, and that's 5,000 people with no microphone.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a star.
How do you do that? How do you pull that off?
Yeah, I think that same thing with Spurgeon. How do you project your voice to that many thousand people?
I had people who would relay it.
Yeah. Or it'd be, you know, what is the life of Brian? Blessed are the cheesemakers.
Yeah.
You know, just lots of mishearing as it goes.
Or 1,000 people hear him and 4,000 are just there for the experience.
But this really was, and when we talk about awakening, part of that was, I mean, as we go to sporting events today, people went to religious gatherings.
Hmm.
And as, you know, Sunday, okay, that's for the amateur. We can go Wednesday. We can go Saturday. We can go, and pretty soon you have, on almost every evening, you're going to have revival meetings. And, you know, what's interesting about the revivals, when it comes to conversions, we have a lot of stories of self-conversion, right? People talking about their own conversion. But when we look at the self-professed conversion from just a statistical point of view, it was really just the same people just going in and out of the...
Yeah.
You know, it's like mega churches today,
yeah.
right? It's you go in and out, and it's really the same group. And
rededicating their life to
rededicating,
Christ.
Yeah, it really, it's, mm-hmm. you know, same old.
You could do, I've heard current Baptists manipulating how many numbers they have of baptized congregants every year by sort of rebaptizing their congregation.
It's a fascination we all have, right? It's a fascination, especially, and this is an American thing. How many people, what's the terrible phrase, how many people do you worship? You know, the kind of, the numbers obsession.
Ron Hodel's answer to that always, one God and three persons.
Exactly, yeah, one or three, it depends. You know, but there's this dichotomy that we start to see in the Enlightenment between the fiercely individualistic, which is kind of a, you know, just a maybe a progression from Luther and the like, but certainly with an American twist. And then a populism, right? A kind of what's popular, who's doing what. And with that populism, a regionalism. And this is important for so many reasons, politically and otherwise. But instead of thinking of themselves as New Hampshire, Georgia, Maryland, it became more of the North and the South. And these were for theological reasons. We see in the beginning of the Great Awakening, we see a split. And we see the kind of heady academic Northeast, Jonathan Edwards, Yale professor, Timothy Dwight, his grandson, who was the president of Yale, And then down in the South, you have these kind of firebrand, really American frontier preachers.
The Apostle?
The Apostle is a great picture of that later on, but that same idea of this very distinctive kind of Southern religion. And that Southern religion would go on to really form, and the Northern religion, two different countries. And so oftentimes when people jump right to the Civil War in American history, there are already massive schisms between the old school and the new school, the old light and the new light. And those are Southern and Northern issues. And so I think that's politically it's important, but also because we're going to see kind of the real populist, you know, kind of mega church, big tent come out of the South, and the kind of academic rationalist American religion come out of the Northeast.
Is that because of the location of colleges, university?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the first couple years, the first couple decades of American history, we develop universities, right? They're blossoming, you know, everywhere. And so whether it's Harvard or Yale or Dartmouth or Princeton, do you know why, by the way, this is just fun trivia, why they're called the Ivy League?
No.
They're called the Ivy League because there were four of them, or in Roman numerals, IV. It has nothing to
That's
do.
That's it?
Yes. It has nothing to do
with ivy growing on
It has
building.
Nothing to I mean, sure, they've maybe, you know, played
no
that up.
Kidding.
But it has to do with there were four schools.
I'm very disappointed.
Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth, and Princeton.
Yeah, I always thought it was,
I know,
like
sorry
ivy
to,
on an old
historians
building.
Historians were the worst. Just to ruin all the stories.
No, me. I learned something in the last 50 seconds.
This division you talk about between the North and the South, is there, does the North kind of look down upon the South as kind of an undignified form of Christianity? Is there sort of any sort of animosity?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. And this is going to follow through the centuries in American history. And it's the idea of the Southern yokel, you know, and the Northern sort of elite academic. Mm. And that comes out of a theological background, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, it's built up in so many different ways, but that has to do with the kind of populist frontier revivals during the awakenings and the intellectual, you know, happenings that, you know, and it's worth saying, you know, Yale was formed because they thought Harvard had gone too liberal. And then Dartmouth forms because they think Yale went too liberal. And Princeton forms because the Scottish don't think anyone can do it right but them. Right? There's just they're really interesting, you know, and they're all and we're so it's not like, well, we're growing a lot of universities and they just happen to be in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And so it's you know, an accident of history, but something that's really driven, obviously, as politically and theologically when we look at Northern
I had a church history prof who generalized and said, while we were building our seminaries brick by brick, the revivalists were taking the whole South.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that comes out of the movements, and really in the next episode we'll talk you know, a bit about the Second Great Awakening, but it's all sort of, you know, beginning to foment here. And the South is where, you know, you look at who even settles the South. It's the Scots and the Irish. And it's those coming second generation who get booted out of the Northeast or can't even come up to the Northeast or have to come down through the Mississippi. And so they're already kind of a rough and tumble group. And this kind of lends itself to what becomes the kind of Southern identity that we have today. We don't think of it as Scottish or Irish.
Although I've heard that, like, the people who live in the Ozarks and that we were kind of moonshiner, you know, that they are typically Scottish.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so it's just an interesting one, you know, just one of those things that the division has been, you know, much more than even denominationally in America, that the split has been more regionally. Mm. And we saw that in the 19th century, late 18th and 19th century, a lot of denominations split into North and South. And of course, that is for slavery in many places, but not always. Sometimes it happened 20 years prior because there was such an animosity between the North and the South that as soon as they could split, many of them did.
Since you mentioned the word, I didn't really want to bring it up because it might derail our conversation, but in the First Great Awakening, so well before the invention of the cotton gin and the explosion of slavery in the South, there's still slavery. And is there already are they distinguishing, is Northern Christianity distinguishing itself against Southern Christianity along the slave issue? Or is that
Yeah, you know, I'm it is northern southern, but I think there's more to it, and I think it has to do more with an English and a sort of southern mentality, or an English yeah.
An agrarian,
nativist sort of agrarian mentality,
urban and rural.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways we can slice it up.
Okay,
but that division is kind of coming. Of course, England, think William Wilberforce, and think the great kind of abolitionist movement that outdates America by decades, right?
Yeah.
And that's much more acceptable or present in the Northeast, where it's not in the South. Whitfield's an interesting character because Whitfield himself owned slaves. Right? Georgia, along with Maryland, were the two places that you could go if you were a Catholic. And from Catholicism to just kind of general toleration of different groups, it's where you would go if you were coming from somewhere else, because you didn't want to risk, you know, you've heard about the Mathers up in Massachusetts, so you're going to, you know, hold off. So I think he's in the South, and there's a lot of work in the South, and there's already the slave culture happening, you know, taking place in the South. And it's interesting how little comment there is by some.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just sort of, that's just how you do things.
Yeah, it's just sort of assume this is the way things are.
Sure,
maybe the state of nature.
Yeah,
or something.
And you're not going to mess. You're not going to mess with that. You're not going to make such a fuss culturally that people don't listen to your theological message. And I think that's what we're going to see.
You mentioned that there's a in the Northeast, it's kind of an intellectual sort of great awakening. But is it also true though that in the Northeast, it's still one of the things that makes it a great awakening? It's still very emotional.
Absolutely.
One of the things that years ago I read something on the First Great Awakening, and they described it as comparing it to the Second Great Awakening, still maintaining the traditional doctrine, but also adding to it the emotional and the spiritual.
Didn't Edwards himself wrestle with that in a book?
I mean, Edwards' great, you know, his sermon is Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. His book is called The Religious Affections.
Yes. Mm.
And what that book is trying to decide is what kind of affections or feelings can we rightly say are religious, and what might we say are just, you know, the happenstance of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that did trouble him in a way, but he wanted to figure it out. By the time we get to the Second Great Awakening, you know, goodbye.
Yeah. When you see Luther in his commentary on Galatians, in the section on Galatians 5 and the fruit of the Spirit struggles with this also. He's got a long section on sort of figuring out which came first, the emotions or the Holy Spirit.
And every tradition goes through this, right? And it's usually with the juniors, the second generation. Well, we like what they did, but if only we could go a step further.
Mm.
And you're going to see this in Lutheranism. You're going to see this in the Reformed. And here we see it in American Christianity. We dig that doctrinal stuff, but let me show you what we can add here. A little bit of, you know, get that. You know, organ going, and you know, and people are excited, and that becomes the next post for the faith. And we see that, like I said, in we would be familiar with Lutheran Pietism. Yep. It's just the same impulse happening across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and also the other thing was we retained our languages from Europe for a long time when others didn't.
Speaking of the Lutheran distinctive, yes,
yep.
Everyone else was singing hymns that were translated into the vernacular, and people had this kind of common English tongue, and there were certain groups, the Germans among them, who didn't assimilate in that way.
Interesting. So one of the things, I don't know, I remember when studying this period, which I didn't do extensively, is it seems to be a relationship between religious revival and moral revival. Is that true, or is that sort of a...
Oh, it's all hand in hand. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Like, are they...
We're still working in an age where I would say until 1848 is a big year, but until the second half of the 19th century, religious life and social life are one and the same. The idea of the secular doesn't really exist. And so if you are zealous for religion, that oftentimes means you are zealous, if not for doctrine, then for moral reasons. And so while this is happening, if you look across the pond, you see this is the beginning of the Victorian type era, right? When you look at prohibition movements, right? Those come out of this movement. And so I think it's very fair to say, yeah, that we have these kind of moral movements, these religious movements. What happens in America in the next few generations is this kind of warps itself into something we call today post-millennialism, post-millennialism is an idea about the end times, that there's a millennium of peace on earth, right? But the post refers to when Jesus comes back, which means post, after the millennium. Well, how on earth do we have a millennium of peace before Jesus comes back?
On the basis of one verse.
The Salvation Army, right? I mean, these groups, right? Onward Christian Soldiers. And they're going to form this kind of Christian society. So that's very much a 19th century, but it's beginning here with this first Great Awakening.
Starting with the outlying booze.
Yep, yep.
It's an easy one. I mean, I think it's kind of like the low-hanging fruit, right?
Not really. It took them a long time. There was at least two, if not three, distinct movements to try to pull it off.
But this is oftentimes, and this goes back to the Reformation, or ideas in the Reformation about how do we blend the church and the state? How do these things, now that we have these little broken-off pieces called states instead of this big empire, how do we do it? And the practical, you know, government-minded person thinks, how do we know if this is working? You know, people aren't being as naughty, right? That's, and there's that sort of, that a moral reform is going to come along with the religious reform. That great theologians say your bit, have, you know, do what you will, unless we see some actions here. We're going to move on to the next movement that promises us something. It's a transactional thing we see, I think, throughout the modern period.
Cool. So you brought up last episode something I thought that we should probably pick up on, which was the difference between tolerance and liberty. In fact, I think that made up a huge section of our conversation in the last episode because it was so sort of foundational to the Constitution and the founding members of the United States. So can we see, can I ask a question? What influence on this tolerance versus liberty balance does the revival have, this Great Awakening?
Yeah, it comes right out of religious liberty. Religious tolerance says there is a dominant or recognized state religion, but we will allow, and usually enumerated groups, the Lutherans, the Reformed, that's how it happens in the Reformation. So toleration allows for, you know, you can sign up and be one of the recognized groups.
Be approved.
Be approved. Mm-hmm. Liberty says, have at it. If you go out into a yard and start speaking from a barrel and thousands of people come out, all right. That's the American way. That's the way of liberty. You don't have to sign up. There's no kind of thing in place. And that's the American experiment. Mm-hmm. Right? We don't have anything in place. So we can say, let's start from nothing. And in a way we do, in a way which other countries just couldn't by accident of time.
This is all happening as the Enlightenment's starting to take off. What are the connections between the Enlightenment and the
Enlightenment. Yeah, Adam, as you know, we taught for years together, and I love teaching the Enlightenment.
Enlightenments, thank you
very much. It is such a variegated history mm-hmm. that when we think of it, we tend to think of the French philosophes mm-hmm. and then Kant and the Germans. Mm-hmm. There it is. But if we look beyond that, if we look at people like Bacon, right, and Descartes in the continental sense, and we move into Jonathan Edwards, right, the Enlightenment becomes a much, I think, more understandable time period, and it's not just a couple cynics saying, eh.
Yeah.
So the ideas behind the Enlightenment are the ideas I've said before in print, to be happy, rational, and free. And those are the general ideas that we see throughout the German, English, French, and American Enlightenments. So happiness, obviously, we're going to go Jefferson and the Declaration and the like. Rationality, we're going to see not only in, say, David Hume and Kant and the idea that that's all we have.
Thomas Reed,
more, sure.
More common sense.
Common sense, but also a rationality when it comes to religion and Christianity and the defense of Christianity.
Well, Calvinism, even strongly held, moved into Unitarian.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this is, and there's a kind of academic mindset of both rationality in the sense of brute rationalism, which you see in the sort of strict materialism, which is about to come, but also that rationalism which we would see in forms of Calvinism and sort of you know, the use of reason, which you guys do, you know, you guys have talked about at length. So the Enlightenment, and then that last idea, freedom, political freedom, religious freedom, liberty in general. Mm. And liberty, as you know, Adam, it's really messy in history. And when you let liberty in, you let in a lot of riffraff. And in a way, the awakenings are kind of the riffraff, you know, getting to wave their flag for a bit. And that's what we get. You know, that's kind of the American and that's an Enlightenment tradition.
Yeah, so, that's interesting because it's almost counterintuitive. You would think, because when, like you said, when you think of the Enlightenment, you think of Descartes, Voltaire, and it gets maybe Thomas Paine over in America, and it gets worse, right? And it's juxtaposed against Christianity or the church or so on. But you're suggesting that actually the Enlightenment, and I think you're right, is a much bigger phenomenon.
It's a much bigger movement. I think that the move you need to make is the supernatural move. That the great division during this age is between people who believe that the supernatural is possible and those who categorically say a priori can't happen, Hume, etc.
Interesting.
When we divide the Enlightenment into supernatural and anti-supernatural, then I think we have a really helpful way of saying, okay, Voltaire versus Diderot versus Paine, the deists versus the cynics, and the new atheists. I think that's really helpful. That's one way of splitting it up. Mm. And then I think you can look at, as we do, the continental, you know, philosophy versus, you know, what's happening in England. We can divide it up in all sorts of ways. And just as it's diverse in Europe, it's just as diverse over here because there's a constant stream coming back and forth. Mm.
Does this cause division amongst Christians who were non-revivalists, maybe like European denominations that weren't part of the phenomenon?
You know, I think we tend to think of religion in America. I tend to think of it like the town I grew up in, Irvine, California. Not sexy at all. And there's a street right in the middle of Irvine, California, and it has all the different churches, one after the next, right? It's all the mainline churches, the PCUSA, the Methodist, right?
Yeah, they were assigned by Irvine.
Exactly. And so when we think
the government?
Of religious sort of liberty or pluralism in that sense, we think of everyone kind of living together. That's not really the case in the colonies in early America. You are living with people because you agree theologically. Mm-hmm. And that's so central to your community that you're not going to have a Quaker and a Presbyterian together. It's just not going to happen.
Well, that happened during the Reformation era when there was so much pressure to unite against the Turk. Mm-hmm. And to say, unless we have theological agreement, we can't be soldiers next to one another. And that was very real.
Yeah, and this is the story of confessionalization, we call it in the Reformation studies, and the same thing here. So, you know, the Lutherans, their story is, you know, parts of Pennsylvania and of certainly the Midwest, and the Congregationalists, their story is the Northeast, and the Baptist, their story is Rhode Island to the South. It's regional and theological in a way that we just don't understand today. One, because we can move so easily, right? Mm. So everything is jumbled.
What American denominations or traditions do we have that around with us now that are heavily influenced or from this tradition of awakenings?
Oh, goodness. Well, the next generation of awakenings is the first generation that starts to say, we're going to do it ourselves. And so that will look like Christian Missionary Alliance. That will look like various groups of Baptists. It'll also look like Mormons and mm-hmm. Christian Scientists, and as everyone in the burnt over district, as people start to form new movements, those are the movements we get, right? The conservative ones are the Disciples of Christ and the Christian Missionary Alliance, and the others range from LDS to the JWs. And so it's a pretty radical period.
It seems like there's a lot in flux here. And what was, I don't know, you put the dates on it, and I was thinking we were farther forward, which is
it's happening. I mean, we were talking about constitutional things, and as that's happening, so are these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really on top of each other.
So what, like, are we getting sort of gonna, you said this sort of faith and reason dynamic mm-hmm. here is going on. Are we gonna see a separation of religious peoples who believe there is a reasonable faith and like miracles and things like that can be you can still have it, and the shedding off of that, do these form different groups as well? Like,
This is the beginning of, you know, what we today would say is culture, right? Or what a secular kind of, you know, neutral at best view of society. That exists only after 1848 and the revolutions and Marx and Darwin and what that world creates. That's forming. In terms of the head and the heart, you know, this is a distinction that, just like the Lutheran Pietists pick up, so too do these colonial, you know, Americans and Christians. It's that head versus heart distinction, and that's where they're going to start fighting against each other as well, because various forms are going to say, you know, it's an issue of emphasis, which for the historian is tough, you know, because we don't have a direct line. It's just, you know it when you see it, kind of.
We're talking about sort of a long-winded preaching. I think before the show, I don't know if we talked about it on the show, that some Whitfield, you, I think one of you mentioned, would preach for upwards of 3 hours.
Easy. 3 hours, like, no problem. Yeah.
Does this form, I mean, that's so long. For Lutherans, we're like 15 minutes,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Start looking at our watches at 10, 12 minutes.
Which is kind of funny when you think about it for people where preaching is so central to our theology, but we like it short.
We just get to the point faster.
Yeah. That's true. Does this set a precedent or a style of worship and gathering in general? Outside of preaching, even hymnody, the way people pray, things like that?
They're, what is it? Lex orandi, lex credendi, right? Mm-hmm. These things always come together, right? In the Reformation, oftentimes for good, when we see Luther's hymns and we see other hymns. In the era of the Great Awakening, we see sort of the same thing. Not only do we need new ways of expressing our faith in speech, but also in song. And there's a contemporary music of the day, right? This idea of contemporary versus traditional being a modern thing, no, it's always the case, right? So long as there's traditional music, or contemporary music, I should say, there's going to be this battle.
Organ versus lyre.
Yeah, exactly, organ versus lyre. And here it's going to be the calliope, you know? John Philip Sousa, you know, that's popular music. And it's popular, not to me, but I don't care for it, but it does evoke emotion in people, right? And so, someone sees that. Says that gets that gets them all riled up.
Tell a short story?
Sure.
I was at the Urbana Missions Convention, which was the North American missions gathering. And I was back in the back with the organist, and he said to me, "You want to see people raise their hands?" I said, "You're kidding." He said, "Watch this." And with cording, all sorts of hands started to raise. Then he said to me, "Do you want to see me take the hands down?" I said, "Good grief." He said, "Watch this."
It's as psychological as it is. And this is the story of the Great Awakening, a blending or a mixing of the psychological and the theological. And sometimes we have a hard time telling where the middle is. And at least people like Edwards said, this is the question we need to ask. It's the later generations that say, it's a division somewhere. Let's be free.
And I'm trying to think of some of the last things on my mind for this section. But I guess with the Enlightenment, if we talk about individualism.
Yeah.
This movement, like you said, is sort of different in one way in the supernatural distinction, but it also seems very communal. You also said that regions are popping up where it's basically, you know, if you're Protestant, do not enter here, or if you're Catholic, you're not gonna move anywhere near X state or X town.
It's worth noticing again just how silly and modern we are.
Okay.
That when we think of individualism, we go direct into ourselves, into our own soul, out on a jetty, you know, at Corona del Mar with no one else around us for miles, right? That's how we do it. Individualism for them meant the emperor isn't going to tell my family, farm, community what to do, right?
Preacher might, right?
Because you brought the preacher in, right? And I think different elements post-Reformation when those two things split. But the individualism we see today of just me and my Bible, sure, that's present, but it was necessarily communal in those early days because that's the only way you could survive. And so individualism wasn't just, you know, even at its worst, still needed its neighbor in a way that we don't always today.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, you don't take into account that we can get food from anywhere in the world and not from the person growing it two doors down.
Yeah. I think you're even talking about worship and study of the scriptures.
Absolutely.
We see that, I mean, well, I don't know about we, but there's a sort of a push for your quiet time.
You know,
wake up in the morning, go somewhere where no one else is.
Yeah.
Pray, read your devotional, read your Bible. Be sure you're spending that time with God every day, individually with God every day. And I think I hear you saying that wasn't a part of this.
No. I mean, it's assumed that you have private time, as anyone would. It's assumed that part of your private time is reading the Word of God. But it doesn't become this new lens by which we're going to judge who's really saved and who needs to get to another meeting. And that's where it becomes dangerous. Not that these are bad things in and of themselves. I will tell you one thing that grows up out of this. Have you ever been in a room and someone says, hey, let's pray? Fine, good thing to do. And then it goes 5 minutes and then 10 minutes. And then someone else starts going. And it's not on a script at all. And it just keeps going and going. Thank the Great Awakening. This kind of prayer, extemporaneous public prayer.
The prayer circle? I need to forward you something. It's how to escape a prayer circle.
It's
like a list of 12 things you can do. But that, last resort is start ripping off limbs.
So, I mean, the idea is, sure, prayer and reading the Bible, these are fine things in and of themselves. It's just like with a lot of things American, we like to get them supersize them to crazy.
It's sometimes. Like there's an old, well, it's not old, but praise song, I guess, called "I Could Sing of Your Love Forever."
Mm-hmm. I guess.
And I've sat in services
old?
Where, well, I mean, 20
it's
years
old
maybe.
Now, cause
they just
old.
Sing "I Could Sing of Your Love Forever" for what seems like
forever.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It's a strangely self-referential sort of meta activity, singing about how you're going to sing about the love of something like it's, hey, you know, hey, whatever floats your boat.
I'm just gonna say it's a little strange.
Well, I mean, do we want to end on that note? Is there anything we missed that we should have asked you, Dan? That
Time we come together, we're going to talk about the Second Great Awakening, and that takes us sort of into the Civil War and up to the doorstep of the 20th century. And a lot of the things that we talked about here, as we said, kind of go crazy in the next class.
Well, sounds fun.
In the next class.
Sorry, I know.
Because we're all sitting here like students.
I typed out notes and everything. So, well, thanks. Yeah. It's fun to be here. Thanks.
Well, it's been great to have you. I'm enjoying these episodes. I think people at home are. The feedback on this kind of thing is always great. And like I said the last time, this is something so new compared to what we've done on the show before, which has been reformational. It's kind of cool to see things growing forward. So it's been great to have you on. Hey, if you like this episode of Thinking Fellows, you've been a long-time listener, maybe you're a new listener, please help us support what we're doing here on this podcast and the rest of them by going to 1517.org/donate. I'll have a link in the show. We are supported by listeners and donors. We don't make money doing this show through some conventional means. And so if you could please think about and consider supporting us, that would go a long way. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.